tape identification, interview with Sir Paul Hasluck, and we're discussing the interesting case of Miss Olive Pink, who worked for many years in the Northern Territory, and Sir Paul's recollections of Miss Pink. And this interview is being conducted for Daniel Connell for his documentary on her life and work, End of ID. Sir Paul, I believe you were aware of the anthropological work of Miss Pink well before well before the war. Was it valuable work? Can you comment on it?
Oh, I can't make any comment on the value of it, but in the pre-war years I was doing a lot of reading in anthropology and, of course, became aware of the papers which were published in Oceania of Miss Pink's early work in the Northern Territory. So I knew there was such a person, but I didn't know much about her. And I haven't got the professional qualifications to evaluate her work.
But did you find it personally helpful yourself when you read it?
I found it interesting.
Right. That was, however, before you met her.
Yes.
And you did subsequently meet her on several occasions.
Yes.
Can you recall what those visits and occasions were like?
Well, in 1951 I became Minister for Territories, and I remember one of my earliest acquaintances with the Territory was a visit to Alice Springs in 1951 to meet the Centralian Pastoralist Association. We were having a day-long conference in the local schoolroom when I became aware of a strange figure in a pith helmet which seemed to be stalking along outside and peering through the windows to see what was happening. And so I asked some official who was nearby, I said, who is that? And he said, oh, that's Miss Pink. She's wanting to find out what the conspiracy is. She's heard that you're talking to the pastoralists before you're talking to anyone else, and so she thinks there's a conspiracy to do the dirty on the blacks.
Were you able to reassure her this wasn't happening?
Oh, yes. The following day, by appointment, she called on me, and I was able to assure her that we'd been talking about cattle and the production of beef and nothing at all about Aborigines, not even their wages. Of course, that was a subject in which she was very interested, the fact that they ought to be paid wages. And I made a pleasant impression on her because after the following morning at breakfast, one of the territory officials said, well, you've done all right for yourself, but not much good for us, because Miss Pink's going around the town saying that it's a pity that all the officials don't learn manners from their minister. Apparently what had happened, he told me, was that just in accordance with the custom that I invariably have, when she entered the room, I stood up and offered her chair to her, and then when she sat down, I sat down. And she said that her experience with the minister was that he was a gentleman, but with officials, they just sat behind their desks and said, what do you want? Now, after that pleasant beginning, I saw her frequently, and much more frequently, had letters from her. She used to write to me in different coloured inks on all sorts of subjects, mostly complaints about what somebody had failed to do, mostly what they'd failed to do, and now and again, of course, something that they'd done wrongly.
You actually eventually ended as, from what I can gather, having social visits with her. Would that be right?
Oh, yes. Well, it was always. I like to use old-fashioned terms, and she was what I call a lady in manners and speech and general demeanour. She was a lady, identifiably a lady. And it was pleasant to talk to her and pleasant to get on with her. And I don't think I ever visited Alice Springs without either she came on deputation to me to complain of something. And in later years, after she had moved out to the Arid Regions Reserve and had her abode there, she wanted to show me what she was doing, and I used to go out there and usually have morning tea with her. I suppose I did that, or at least a dozen times.
Were those gracious occasions?
Oh, quite. She was living rather crudely in this what was a hut, which had been transferred from the town. But she had the morning tea set out very graciously with, you know, the teacups and the teapot and a tea cosy and little doily covering the milk jug, even if it was condensed milk. And she'd have gone to the trouble, I think, of buying some cake or something like that. And it was all done in Government House style. And we got on very well.
She was an early conservationist, wasn't she?
I think part of her interest in Aborigines was that of a conservationist rather than an anthropologist.
In fact, before we get on to that, I recall reading recently that, in fact, there were some trees with which you have some personal connection. Would you mind recounting the narrative of those?
Oh, after she had established the Arid Regions Reserve and was having various difficulties, and I had helped her to get over these, I found that someone told me first, and then I saw it on the ground, that she had planted some indigenous trees and given them names. There was one tree that she called Mr. Marsh, and another tree that she'd called Mr. Archer, and another tree that she'd called Mr. Hasluck. And what she did was, according to whether we were in favour or not, she either continued to water the trees or stopped watering them. So if you went out there and found that Mr. Archer was drooping, you knew that Mr. Archer had done something of which he disapproved. On the other hand, if you found that one of the other trees was flourishing, you knew that that officer... And I always used to take great heart from the fact that Mr. Hasluck was always flourishing.
I was just going to say, is Mr. Hasluck still flourishing?
Yes, I saw it when I went to open the Arid Regions Reserve a couple of years ago. It was still there. It's not a great tree because it was one of the local rather stunted trees. I suppose that's completely in keeping with my own reputation.
The actual establishment of the reserve was achieved not without difficulty, I believe.
I know. There's one thing to realise about Miss Pink is that she always wanted her own way, and she was very clever in getting her own way. And the history of this was that she was originally living almost in the heart of Alice Springs in Gregory Terrace in a hut. And with the post-war development of the town, the whole part of that town was being redeveloped. And although she claimed to that it was her hut, I think the strength of it was that she may have had some claim to own this building, having paid a few pounds for it in the early post-war years. But she certainly had no title to the land, and in official terms, she was a squatter. And she resisted strongly to what she called this eviction by unprincipled and wicked persons. And that's where I first came to share some of her troubles, because then I asked the administration to tell me about it, and they gave me that position. I said, well, let's see if we can arrange something for her. Can we shift the hut to... We have to resume this land for town improvement, and she has no claim to the land. Can we shift her to a more congenial place? And the first place we suggested, she rejected, and then eventually she agreed to the site that later became the Arid Regions Reserve. And my interpretation, which may be a little bit cynical, is that having got onto this new spot and liking it, she thought one way of protecting myself from further trespass and from, losing the place eventually is to have it declared a reserve. And so she came up with a very good idea, which she'd probably had in the back of her mind for a long time, that there was a need in proximity to the town to preserve a fair chunk of the original land in the way in which it was originally, and have it as a botanical reserve for the plants of the arid region. Now, that was something I was in complete sympathy with, and I said, well, let's by all means do this. And so we went out and with the, I think it was with the Director of Lands, yes. We paced it out and walked around all the hills and agreed where the, with her views as to where the boundary ought to be, and somewhere about, I think in the middle 50s, it was declared a reserve, and her hut was in the centre of it. And so she had no risk that somebody would say, we want this for building houses in the town. And so it was a mixture, I think. I think I'm fair to her, and so it was a mixture of protecting her own hut and her very genuine enthusiasm for conservation.
You describe her in your notes somewhere as intelligent but difficult.
Oh, she was difficult. Of course, that's where I was in an easy position. A difficult woman like that, and she was difficult, becomes a problem to the public servant. But she's no problem to the minister, who can just say, as I did in that case, say, well, let's see if we can shift the hut. The public servant can't say that. She remained to the last moment a problem to the diligent public servant, but a minister could say, oh, well, let's give a point, let's concede, let's humour her. She was never a problem to me. She was just a very interesting and, in some ways, delightful eccentric.
Did you have problems persuading your public servants to take her seriously?
Oh, no, most of the, particularly some of the senior public servants, they were completely sympathetic to her, and particularly the assistant administrator at one time, Mr. Reginald Marsh, who got a tree in his honour. He was most sympathetic and helpful to her. And so was the Director of Lands. You know, once they knew that the minister wouldn't correct them for doing something that they shouldn't do.
So they really needed your moral support.
Oh, yes. Just a word to say, look, we can stretch a point for this. We needn't be too strict.
Now, the other side of her work was her passionate belief in justice for Aboriginal people.
Yes.
What was your impression of what she was doing in that area?
I think she was very, she had very mixed ideas, and I don't think, well, I never detected in her a very clear notion of what the eventual outcome would be, but she wanted them to not to be hurt or destroyed, you know. But I mean, I would doubt very much whether if she were alive today she would see much sense in current policies. But for example, she was very strongly in favour of paying them full wages for station labour, and as a result of that, their transition to the same status as European workers in the general community, not a separate development as tribal Aborigines. And yet, of course, she was very keen on conserving the Aboriginal traditions and the customs. I think of her more as a conservationist than as a social reformer.
And that would have been a problem, I guess, in the sense that cultures, unlike fauna and flora, evolve a bit more rapidly.
Yes, yes. Well, taking up that point, you know, cultures do evolve, and she would see the possibility of changing the nature of Aboriginal life and the general circumstances of Aboriginal life, so long it was, in her terms, improved and was not unjust, whereas she would not see any possibility botanically of changing the nature of the arid region. And so in the case of the arid region, don't alter it. But I don't think she would have gone to the point of saying, don't alter the conditions of life of the Aborigines. If they have the opportunity to become like Europeans, let them become like Europeans.
Hence the push for pay and
yes,
improved conditions.
Yes. She wanted fair treatment for them, no injustice, and proper recognition of their place. And of course she, like most eccentrics, a good deal of her thinking was a fear of all the other wicked people in the world. You know, pastoralists were wicked just by nature. They were only interested in cattle, so they couldn't possibly be interested in human beings. And public servants, they were only bent on collecting taxes and ordering people around, so they couldn't possibly have the virtues of other human beings. She was a bit inimical to the rest of humanity.
Well, you would have known, obviously, the public servants, but also the pastoralists. What was their view of Miss Pink?
Oh, that varied from person to person. I mean, some amiable old fellow like Bill Breitling of Mount Doreen, who had seen her in her early anthropological days, he was very tolerant and kindly to her and thought she was, a funny old stick, but quite a good woman. Whereas others would think of her as an interfering old person who didn't know anything about the problems of raising cattle.
She was, in every way, a local identity, wasn't
she? Oh, yes, very much.
So, if you were asked to sort of describe what kind of influence she had on Alice Springs and the area around it, could you describe that?
Well, I think it was a diminishing influence because Alice Springs itself was changing. You see, in 1950 is when I first had a close knowledge of it. Alice Springs was a very distinctive community, unlike the rest of the territory and unlike the rest of Australia. Very distinctive community and a very amiable and pleasant community. By the time I left the territory in the middle of the 1860s, Alice Springs was a thriving, expanding people full of Johnny-come-latelys who knew nothing about the early days and who were completely different. It was a different community. We transformed it.
Would you like to just rephrase that? Because I think you're venerable, Sir Paul, but I think you just said the 1860s. So.
Oh.
If you want to rephrase it, it'll save us editing it.
What?
You're saying by the time I left Alice Springs in the 1860s, that obviously you'd like to switch yourself forward 100 years.
Oh, yes.
Just throw that phrase in, and it's easy.
What?
I made
a mistake because, as in so many other things, I live in the past. I said 1860 instead of 1960s.
That's fine. Yes.
Perhaps I'm engrossed in the 1860s simply because I've just been writing up some funny papers that my father left dealing with those early years in the colony.
Fascinating period, too. If we look at Miss Pink's life before Alice Springs, what do we know about her life, her early life? Are there aspects of her personality, or rather her background, which explain her personality?
Well, one thing I think that must have been influential, she was, when she was in Western Australia, she came to Western Australia with, I think it was Admiral Bedford when he became governor, came from Tasmania and lived in the government house household and had that sort of viceregal ambience and gentility, and it left a mark on her. I referred to her previously as unmistakably a lady, and both in manner and in outlook she was ladylike. And of course that was the period when, in government, still moving in government house circles in Western Australia, she had the one romance of her life. I don't know whether there was a formal engagement, I'm not quite sure about that, but the young man was killed early in the 1914-18 war, and it, as far as I know by repute, it was the only love of her life and something that was deep, very much in the whole of her being.
There was never another relationship?
No, I've never heard of any sort of relationship. And, of course, my personal acquaintance with her was when she was in her late 50s. And, of course, not all ladies undergo a major transformation of sexual interest in the 50s, but it's less ardent, and one never detected in her any sort of male-feminine relationship. She was completely natural in just taking me as a gentleman caller. I'll tell you, there was one very lady-like embarrassment that she had. When she first moved to the arid zone hut and was living in a hut, her only sanitary convenience was a roofless little shed, which just some sheets of galvanized iron surrounding the pedestal and the pan. And on one of her visits, in the most ladylike way, without using a single word that was would cause a blush of shame to any with the most delicate face, she conveyed to me that she found it embarrassing not having a roof above her, because when she went there, apparently the word was passed immediately to the town aerodrome, and they sent off aeroplanes that flew overhead and peered down upon her. And she conveyed her sense of embarrassment that these aeroplanes flew overhead and could look through her roofless dunnikin. And she did that in the most ladylike way, meaning clear, but not a single precise word spoken.
Well, when you knew her, what was she like in appearance?
She was tallish, a little bit gaunt in frame. I don't think she fed herself properly. Rather gaunt in frame, a very pleasant... her face could break into a very pleasant smile and a bit of a sense of fun. And but she was proper, very proper.
What do we owe her, do you think, today?
Well, the big thing, of course, is the this reserve, where right alongside Alice Springs, she has, we now preserve a small museum and a section of a botanical reserve that keeps alive the native arid region as it was originally and has not been disturbed by later developments. We owe her that. I think, by and large, over in an indirect way, she stimulated in her immediate surroundings a feeling that the Aborigines were people to be respected, people to be treated with consideration and kindness, and people who had rights of their own. It would not have been an extensive influence, because in her old age she had become regarded as a bit of an eccentric. But it was an influence. And I think there's a place in the world, a very great place in the world for... particularly today, and I speak as an octogenarian, nearly a nonagenarian, there's a very great place in the world today for two things. One is a few eccentrics and quite a number of old-fashioned people. So many of the old-fashioned values need reviving and respecting, and so many of the objections that the genuine eccentric has to current enthusiasms also need consideration.
So, Paul, thanks very much for talking about Olive Pink.